Hi everyone and welcome to the Genomics Lab podcast, the podcast about current research in the field of genomics.
We are your hosts, Eleanor Watson and Olivia Grant, two PhD students in the genomics group at the University of Essex.
Join us as we speak to researchers in the field about their current research and their journey into genomics. Hello everyone, welcome back to the Genomics Lab. It's time finally for brand new episodes. I'm back with some brand new episodes, got some amazing guests. I have also taken a week's annual leave finally since starting my PhD, so I feel refreshed and ready for just to start making some really cool new episodes. I have filmed 4 episodes this week, so we are ready to go for the next 8 weeks with some really, really cool guests. So let's just get straight into it. So kicking off the first brand new episode. Today, I spoke with Dr. Hamish King is actually the correct way to pronounce it. I did ask him whilst we were filming. So he is a Sir Henry Wellcome Fellow, affiliated with the Blizzard Institute at Queen Mary University of London. And we are talking about epigenetics and the human immune system. Now, during filming this episode, I realized how bad my immunology has got, which is not good, but I did learn a lot from Hamish and he had some really, really interesting stuff to educate me on, which was amazing. So I really, really enjoyed it. So we talk about, he looks at how errors in gene regulation can lead to changes in the function of B cells, which are a cell type in our immune system, which are important for producing antibodies to fight infections. So we talk a lot about, obviously, his research. We talk about wet lab versus bioinformatics and sort of the split that he does in his research, and also a really big congratulations to him as he's also in early 2022 going on to be a lab start up his own lab back in Australia. So that is amazing. So we will talk a little bit about that and the future plans for his lab as well. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. You can obviously find all of the links to his paper, which we discussed, and also his Twitter, where he's happy to be contacted about the research that we discuss and also about any upcoming vacancies in his new lab. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoy. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Genomics Lab. I am happy to be back filming. It's been actually weeks. I think it's been about 6 weeks since I filmed an episode, and I'm joined by the wonderful Hamish. Harmish, which do you prefer? What do people call you, Hamish or Harmish?
It's Hamish. Or
Hamish. Do you get a bit of both?
It happens a few times. I get some different variants, particularly for the French, where they don't have the H, so I get Amish.
Yeah. I'm lucky I've got quite a boring name, so people can't really mess up Olivia.
But people always find ways to surprise you, don't they?
Yeah, that is true. I do get called Olive sometimes, so
there we go.
You're right, people do mess it up. Anyway, so you are a Sir Henry Wellcome Fellow from Queen Mary University of London.
Yes, that's right.
Moving soon, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm really, really excited. I'm going to be starting my lab in Melbourne, Australia, at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute. I'm joining the epigenetics and development department there and going to be sort of delving in more into the how gene regulations can controlled in human B cells.
Amazing, cool. So how comes Australia?
So I'm from Australia. Maybe my accent is
gives it away a little bit.
Dampened over time. So I've been in the UK now nearly 9 years. 9 years this week, actually. Time to head back and take this new step, big new step in the career of a
huge, yeah, huge new step. That's exciting. So did you come over to start your, did you do your PhD in the UK? Tell us a little bit about like your academic journey.
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate back home in Adelaide, South Australia, and I went to Flinders University, which is quite a small university, not very well known. And I did my Bachelor of Science in Molecular and Microbiology, and did my first taste of research there, working on hypoxia and breast cancer cells. And in particular, I was studying exosomes, which are these little nanovesicles released by cells, and they can contain microRNAs, which obviously could be really have important downstream effects on gene regulation. So that was sort of my first taste of it. And I then from there applied to come to the UK to do my PhD, and I ended up in going to Oxford as a Wellcome Trust funded PhD student in the biochemistry department there, working with Rob Close on CpG ions and DNA methylation.
Amazing. Did you continue your postdoc there as well, or?
I did a small bridging postdoc while I was after I finished in my PhD, but then shortly after that moved to London, to Queen Mary, to work at, with Louisa James on using single cell transcriptomics to understand B cell maturation.
Yeah. Amazing. Cool. So yeah, I can see why you're excited to go back to Australia. You've been in the UK for a bit too long.
A very long time.
No, we always say this on the podcast, like I don't know if I told you, but I did my undergraduate and then like went straight into my PhD, and I've been like at Essex the whole time, and obviously in the UK the whole time. So I always feel like the odd one out in academia because I've literally not traveled, and I'm keep thinking to myself, like, I need to travel and, you know, yeah, go to new places.
It's really interesting. I think there's a lot of stigma around that, actually.
I
think it's I don't think it's really good at all. We're not a fair reflection on anything to do with a scientist. I know my supervisor Louisa, she has spent her entire research career from PhD and an undergrad, PhD, postdoc, starting her lab in London, at different universities, mm-hmm. at different institutes, but nonetheless all within the one city. And I think even then she's received some sort of, you know, critical feedback about that in the past. But I think it's really unfortunate. And I've been lucky to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate it. I think you need to go where what you're passionate about takes you. And if that's
I agree.
If it's on your home doorstep, then that's so much the better.
Ideal, finding, Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we had this conversation before actually on one of the episodes, and we were talking to two lecturers from Essex actually, and they were saying about, one of them was saying about how I think she was saying it was maybe a grant application or something, and one of the like reviewers actually commented saying like about like the lack of travel or something. It was something like that. So that's why it always scares me, because there is like a stigma around it, but the thing is I enjoy the UK, you know.
Yeah, I think what is useful is to experience different types of labs and different types of mentors, and I think that is really important, wherever that might be. It doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. have to be, you know, going to the US to do your postdoc, but I think learning how different people do science, especially while you're training, is really important. Mm-hmm. And you learn a lot from that.
Do you find that like all of the labs you've been in have been like really, really different or quite similar?
They have been quite varied, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, some very small, back in Australia, when I first joined a lab, it was a mm-hmm. small lab. My PhD was a sort of, I guess, a medium-sized lab of about, you know, 8 to 12 people in Oxford. And then for my postdoc, I was the first member of Louisa James' lab. I signed on as her first staff member, first postdoc. And then during my fellowship, I went to Cambridge and worked with Sarah Teichman there, which is at the completely opposite end of the spectrum, with a lab cycling between 20 to 30 people at any given moment.
Oh my God, wow.
You know, co-leading the Human Cell Atlas. It's a completely different operation. Mm-hmm. So seeing how these different labs are managed, and I've been very lucky that all of these mm-hmm. labs have been managed by both very kind, but also very clever people. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really rewarding experience, but mm-hmm. It does give you perspective on how, you know, as I now take this next step for myself, starting my own lab.
Yeah, that's so true.
Take all that on board, and hopefully you find your own
take like positives from each lab, I guess, which helps.
Well, that's right, because and you see the positives and you see the negatives and the challenges that come from these any of these different situations. You know, there are positives and negatives.
Yeah, definitely. Because it must be so weird going from a lab where you're the only sort of like student or postdoc, then going to a lab of like 20 to 30 people. That must be so weird.
It's really exciting. You know, really exciting.
Yeah.
You get exposed to a lot more science then, and more ideas are circulating around. I think sometimes that scale, it comes at a cost in terms of time that's available.
But yeah,
as long as you have a good group of people, which I was very fortunate, you know, to be the case at all levels within that lab, it can work really well.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, so obviously you're going to start your new lab, which is amazing. So congratulations. That is a really big step, like you said. Can you then tell us a little bit about like your, like an overview of your research? So what exactly do you focus on?
Yeah, so my background and my PhD was in basic mechanisms of gene regulation around chromatin structure and function, and particularly about how different histone modifying pathways control accessibility at gene regulatory elements like promoters or enhancers, and how that may or may not be linked with transcription from the promoters. And I was sort of studying how all those processes feed into and relate to DNA methylation or histone acetylation, different methylation marks and different pathways associated with that. A lot of those questions were done looking in mouse embryonic stem cells. So really sort of tractable system that you can do lots of fancy genome engineering and build these great, you know, conditional alleles to ask mechanistic questions. But I wanted something a little bit more translatable, a bit more medically relevant. So I for my postdoc, decided to come to Queen Mary and start working on B cells. And this is what I've been focusing on for the last 4 years and what my lab will be focusing on in the future. So maybe I can talk a little bit about B cells and why they're interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Please do, yes.
So people have probably heard of B cells before, and the most, I think, important contribution that they make is that they provide a major source of immune memory to recognize and fight any infection that our bodies might be exposed to. And one of the ways they do this is by making antibodies. So we all know what how important antibodies are from the recent pandemic. It's got a lot of press, a lot of traction about the need for a strong antibody response to a vaccine or past infection. But there's still a lot of basic questions about how B cells produce these antibodies and different types of these antibodies that have remained unresolved or remained to be discovered. So the angle that we took exploring this question was trying to examine the transitional and the dynamics of the B cells during that process using single cell transcriptomics. And we were doing that in human tonsil tissue. So tonsils are very similar to lymph nodes or spleen, and I think everyone's had that feeling when they're getting a bit under the weather or a bit sick and you get the swollen lymph nodes in your neck.
Yes, that's the worst. It is the worst. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's when those lymph nodes are sort of kicking into gear. They've found the sort of something, you know, bacteria or virus, and they're sort of responding to that really vigorously. And so you can imagine that your tonsils actually do a very similar thing. They provide a really, but I guess unlike lymph nodes, they're much easier to get hold of.
Lymph
nodes are very rarely removed from the body, but tonsils are fairly easy to get access to.
So can I ask a quick question? Sorry if I like completely missed a link there. How did we go from B cells to lymph nodes? Sorry.
So the way that B cells make antibodies and they sort of develop a sort of a good quality antibody is they go into tissues like the lymph nodes or the tonsils. So this is the site of their activity, where they're sort of developing that response to make a good quality antibody and provide sort of that long-lived immunity. So typically what will happen is we have B cells that are circulating in our blood all the time, and they're also moving from the blood into the lymphoid system, so passing through lymph nodes and the tonsils. And then while they're passing through, they can be presented with a piece of a bacteria or a piece of a virus or anything else that might be a foreign particle, and they can be activated into what's called a germinal center response. So the germinal center involves that B cell sort of acquiring a series of random mutations in the genes that encode for the antibody to try and improve the recognition of that antigen, of that foreign piece of material. So sometimes those mutations will be advantageous and it will lead to the B cell recognizing that foreign particle better. Most of the time they're deleterious and that B cell will die as a result of that. It's a very complex sort of selection process involving help from other immune populations like T cells and dendritic cells, other cells as well, sort of all working together to help the B cell get the best quality response it can.
So, these mutations always occur?
They will occur, and they occur in the antibody genes in particular. So there's a protein called AID, or AID, which is a cytidine deaminase, which recognizes a very particular motif in the genome, which is most strongly enriched within the antibody gene locus. But interestingly, it can target other parts of the genome as well, and this can lead to some mutations that lead to lymphoma or other B cell disease.
Okay, cool. Interesting. I was about to ask, do we know much about how these mutations occur? But I guess you kind of just addressed that.
Yeah, no, I think we do know broadly how they can occur, but it is quite difficult to understand it in situ. And particularly the regulation of this protein, this AID, is very complex, both in terms of its transcriptional regulation, but post-transcriptional, post-translational modification, and as well as different isoforms that are involved in different parts of these processes as well. So I say broadly, yes, we understand how this works, but I think there's a lot of fine detail that is missing from that.
When I asked you earlier about the link between like B cells and tonsils or lymph nodes, do you know like how the B cells are actually like directed to the lymph nodes?
Yeah, so it is a good question. So they will just be initially just cycling through there as part of their sort of surveillance of the immune system. I actually don't know if that involves a particular expression of different homing markers, just that basic sort of transition through the tissue. But there's definitely particular cytokine receptors involved in honing to different areas within the tissue. And particularly when we start talking about that germinal center reaction, that's really important there in terms of how the cells enter or exit that, and also how they move around within that. Because one of the really fascinating things about that germinal center is it's not just a big pile of cells, of these B cells acquiring these mutations. There's different zones that occur within it. And one of them is called the light zone, and one's called the dark zone. And they're called that because when you look at it under a microscope, one is very light and one is really dark, because that's where the cells are dividing and they're proliferating super rapidly.
I like the simplicity. So I always find that like scientists either name stuff really, really complicated or just like really, really simple things like light zone and dark zone.
Exactly. So I think... Yeah, it's sort of helpful. And this has been described actually for over a century, because it's observable under a microscope, this zone. But it's sort of, we still have a lot to learn about how the cells move and behave within that structure. But one of the things that really fascinates me as well about B cells is not just that they're really important for our immune systems, but in this germinal center, they undergo quite an unusual erasure of a lot of their DNA methylation.
Okay.
Partly because they divide so rapidly, but also there are some evidence for active DNA demethylation occurring at that same stage as well. And if you look at patients...
So you just mentioned their active DNA methylation. So we've got the two forms, obviously active and passive. Could you just describe what is active DNA methylation and how does it differ to passive DNA demethylation?
Yeah, so when I talk about those two things, other people might have different ideas or definitions. But for me, the active process, I think, is best described around the TET enzymes, which can sort of catalyze the methylcytosine to down to hydroxymethyl, and there are other byproducts of that as well. So these are active enzymes that can be targeted to different regions of the genome to remove that methylation. But in contrast to passive dilution of the methylation, so if we imagine that each cell has, you know, it's two copies of DNA and both of those might be methylated, upon division, the two daughter cells acquire one each, and then that has to be re-established in those new daughter cells. But if the cells are dividing so quickly that those methylation processes may be inefficient, then it could dilute a little bit more because the rate at which these cells are dividing is really quite unusual.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that gives a framework for the sort of ideas that I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, sorry, so I interrupted you there. Yeah, so we were talking about active DNA methylation these B cells.
That's
yeah.
Right. But just to say, I think that it is a really quite an unusual situation, and that there are there's good evidence that patients with different immunodeficiencies related to their B cells have different levels of global DNA methylation.
Interesting.
Which I think points to a defect upstream in that processing in the germinal center.
Mm-hmm.
Where something hasn't quite gone right, they haven't been able to maintain it as long, and maybe haven't lost it as much, or haven't reacquired it during differentiation and exit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think, a really interesting and important system to ask questions about epigenetics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, so the main things, maybe I can talk about some of the questions we tried to ask and answer in particular within my postdoc, and how that's leading to the next stages. So,
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So one of the challenges that you might be coming across with how I'm talking about it might not be, is just how dynamic the system is, and how these cell fate transitions that occur can occur really rapidly, and might be quite hard to identify in the tissue itself,
mm-hmm.
Using bulk genomic approaches. So typically, how we might approach these questions is to sort for particular B cell populations, and then to do RNA sequencing or chip sequencing, mm-hmm. or other assays. I'm sure everyone is familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But this has a real limitation in that any of these really rare transitional cell states might not fall within your flow cytometry gates that you're using to enrich for different populations.
Mm-hmm.
They might be too rare. They might have not been discovered yet. We don't really understand all the intricacies. So we wanted to try and tackle some of that by using single cell transcriptomics to, in an unbiased way, profile all the different cellular states that exist within this process, using the tonsils as a model mm-hmm. organ, model example of this process. Mm-hmm. And so we did that, and we looked at seven different individuals, profiled just over 35,000 cells, single cells with a transcriptome, using the 10x genomics platform. And from that, we were able to cluster the single cell transcriptomes and identify all the major cellular states that we expected, but also some surprising more rare populations that we could then characterize in terms of the transcriptional activity and speculate on what their mm-hmm. importance might be.
It sounds amazing. So I've got two questions off this. The first one is probably a more of a broad one, which is, first of all, like, I always like to make this link, like, why is it so important that we understand more about, like, all of these processes? Like, why? So for people who don't, I guess, have much of a background in genomics, we have a lot of people who listen are just like maybe doing their undergrad in biomed or something. So what is the bigger picture of the research? Like, what exactly, are there any particular diseases that we're interested in or anything like that?
Yeah, so I think one, in some sense, when we study these types of processes in the immune system, you could think about any type of infectious disease relies upon these processes working well.
Mm-hmm.
If these processes aren't up to scratch, then you won't be able to mount an effective immune response, and you won't remember that infection, and you're liable to keep on getting that infection again.
Mm-hmm.
So patients with different immunodeficiency diseases, this can often be the case. They can have mutations in key genes that are required for this process, and they just can't form the effective B cell mm-hmm. memory.
Mm-hmm.
There are other types of immune memory as well, but I won't go into those today. But just to say that, and so in some sense, we have nearly all infectious diseases that have some relevance towards. And on the other hand, autoimmunity is really relevant to this.
Mm-hmm.
So what can happen is normally these B cells are trying to recognize foreign objects in your body, mm-hmm. parts of bacteria or viruses. But there are systems that prevent them from normally recognizing parts of our own body. You know, the sort of idea of recognizing self and recognizing non-self. Sometimes what can happen is that the B cells do end up targeting self antigens that are just normal proteins made by our bodies, and that can lead to autoimmune disease, such as lupus, multiple sclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease, and many, many others. And although, again, that's a very, very complex and very broad set of diseases, and B cells aren't relevant to all of them, there are particular contexts where we know that B cells play a key role in making antibodies that recognize the self proteins. So the hope is that by understanding these more basic fundamental cellular states that occur during this process and the genes involved in those cellular populations, that this can provide a baseline, if you like, to then transition and move into more disease-specific contexts and mm-hmm. see how B cells in disease are different to those in health in these ways.
It's interesting to hear that, because the way I always think is, which is probably not the best way to think, I always think, like, so say for example it was me doing this, I mean, I probably might think differently if I knew more about the topic, but I always think that it's easier to, or it makes more sense in my head to look at, like, let's say for example, to look at autoimmunity and see what's going wrong rather than trying to figure out that afterwards. Does that make any sense?
No, absolutely. And there are a lot of problems with just the simplistic idea I described of, you know, taking data from a tonsil and saying that's going to tell us anything about multiple sclerosis. And that's, you know, many, many steps in between that.
Yeah, I can see both sides, but, like, my brain always goes straight to, like, what's going wrong and let's figure out what's going wrong, because then that can teach us about how it actually works. But both approaches are interesting, but it's interesting to hear, because mostly when I talk to people, they're always doing the second option rather than the way that you're doing it. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I would say that we definitely came to it more with a basic fundamental approach rather than mm-hmm. this is going to tackle this disease. It really mm-hmm. is, I think, the priority of just
for a process
that, like I mentioned earlier, these germinal centers have been observed over 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and yet there's so many questions about what is going on inside them,
mm-hmm.
That we are just trying to understand more about that, and, you know, I hope that, you know, down the line that could could lead to some kind of translation or insight into something. Yeah. But very much it's I think we approach it from a fundamental, we need to understand this better. It's an important part of our bodies.
So why do you think we like, you know, so little, or the field knows so little about them? Like, there must be some pretty big limitations into sort of looking at these things.
Yeah, so I think I mentioned some of them before in terms of how dynamic this process mm-hmm. is. It is quite difficult to understand what's happening in human tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, mouse biology and immunology has made huge inroads, and a lot of what we know about this process comes from mouse models, mm-hmm. Knockouts and otherwise, because, you know, you can do really simple, elegant experiments of giving, you know, infecting them with a particular virus or even just a single protein, and then tracking the cells that respond to that single protein through time in, you know, throughout an immune response. So that's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's a need, you know, to be honest, to move beyond just mouse models and study mm-hmm. in human as a model organism, which we're primarily most interested in, to be honest, for a lot of these questions about human health.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are also some key differences in between mouse B cells and human B cells, and particularly in the types of antibodies that they make, the types of cytokines that control their differentiation, and
you know,
the lives that we live. The lives that we live are very different to the laboratory mouse. So,
right. Yeah, because, again, this is a conversation that we have a lot. Is like, and me and Ellie used to debate it a lot, was like how, you know, like generalized. I know everyone's always says obviously it is a great model organism, but I think when you're like, I think it does depend on sort of like what kind of mechanisms you're looking at. So what are the differences then between mouse and human B cells? What actually influences the differences?
Yeah, I mean, some of it's just going to be through evolution and genetics. I mean, the best example, I think, is, you know, so humans can make 10 different types of antibodies, IgM, IgD, IgG 1, 2, 3, 4, IgA 1, 2, IgE. There's a whole, you know, there's, and they all do slightly different things. The mouse doesn't make so many. They have, you know, only, I think, or 3 IgG. And 1 IgA. I hope I've got that right, but they don't have the same diversity in terms mm-hmm. of that, and that's important in terms of the functional responses downstream, but also the genetic regulation that might come from that. I think one area though where it's really important to be working with humans is anything involving the genetics of disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the most recent studies that I've been working on has been looking at GWAS genetic variants associated with autoimmune disease, where these are mutations within the genome that many of us will carry that might predispose us in mm-hmm. some way to developing a disease. And in that case, we really need to be looking at human cells, because it's going to be very different in the mouse, which is mm-hmm. separated by, is it 50 or 100 million years of evolution? I can't remember.
I don't know.
It's a very long time.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. Yeah, so are you looking then at genetic and epigenetic side of this? And do you look at how they like interact at all? So do you look at like how genetics impacts epigenetics and likewise?
So not yet. So
not yet.
So one of the things that we've done most recently in this area is using single cell attack sequencing.
Mm-hmm.
So where we can look at the chromatin accessibility in tonsil immune cells. So same as what we had done with the transcriptomics, we're now looking at the chromatin structure to provide other insights into how the genes are controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that was actually, do you remember I said I had two questions?
Oh, there we go.
Sorry, and then I went off on a tangent. My second question was if you could explain what actually is single cell. We have done an episode on it, but I'm not going to assume that everyone has listened to all of the episodes. So could you explain what actually is single cell genomics?
Yeah, that's a good point. I should have covered that a little better earlier on.
No, that's fine.
So it's really I guess a way of looking at single cells in particular ways, in which we had previously needed to look at many hundreds of thousands or millions of cells at once. So historically, if we wanted to understand the genes that were active in a given population of cells, we would need to collect a million of them and then basically process all of them at once. And while that can give us a lot of information, it assumes that all of those 1 million cells are exactly the same and doing exactly the same thing. So instead, what we really want to be able to do is to look at perhaps not 1 million, but as many of those single cells as possible to see whether they are behaving the same. So to do that, there's a couple of ways that you can do it, and they all rely on the principle of separating one cell away from all the other cells to make single cells. So you can either do that by sorting them into a 396-well plate to sort of partition them physically away from one another, or you can use droplet-based chemistry, where this is a high-throughput method of capturing single cells in small droplet emulsions, where they can exist within the same tube, but have a sort of an impermeable barrier.
That's so cool, yeah.
And all the other cells. And the chemistry works in such a way which, you load the cells through this microfluidics machinery, and it captures a single cell, and more often than a single cell, into these small droplets. And then once you've got them in those different spaces, whether it's a well in a dish or in a droplet, you could then, with different molecular biology, ask your question of interest. So if you want to look at the gene expression, if you want to look at its chromatin properties, if you want to look at cell surface markers, you can do that. But I think the key thing is about separating those cells out. And then what you would do is, once you've made a measurement, each cell gets a barcode in terms of the small pieces of DNA that, or RNA that are added to the endogenous sample, that's molecules made by that single cell. And then you can combine all the cells together again and then analyze them on the sequencing machines, and then bioinformatically deconvolve that information again. So you're sort of going from a large population of cells down to single cells, back to a large mixed population, and then back to single cell with the bioinformatics.
Yeah, it's so cool. So cool.
It's pretty amazing, I think. And the technology is just growing faster and faster.
So do you do the wet lab side of things and the bioinformatics side of thing, or are you more one or the other?
That's right. I do both. So I trained initially in my undergrad as a wet lab scientist, and then for my PhD, I working with Rob Close, I went to him and I said, I really want to learn how to do the bioinformatics of this, because I'm interested in genomics and I'm interested in the genome, and next generation sequencing is the future. So I sort of made it a priority for my PhD to learn those skills and develop them. And then since then, my postdoc and looking forward, I very much think that the best way to do this kind of science is to have the ability to understand, at least understand, maybe not execute, but to really understand the wet lab work and the dry lab work, because then you can do the best in both camps. You won't do the best experiment in the lab if you don't understand the downstream analyses or what's going to come from that. And I think vice versa, you can really do the best analysis if you understand the wet lab science as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I definitely I need to get in the lab and learn some stuff, because I literally don't know what I'm doing in the lab. But I just feel like because of COVID, it's just been hard. Yeah. I'm fully computational anyway. But then just even trying to get like, because I know Radu would have pushed me to like do something, and he still is trying, but it's just difficult, you know, like I just haven't had the chance yet to do that. And then now the chance is coming up, we're just relying on our data going one particular way for me to get the chance to go and work with some other people in the lab. But if the data, you know, if I don't produce the data through like my computational work, then I don't know if that's going to happen, you know?
I think it's such a hard thing. And to be honest, I hear this same type of experience more often from the other side of the wet lab scientists who are like, you know, really want to you know, analyze their data directly. But I think in both cases it's the same problem, which is about carving out time.
Exactly, and
I think carving out time in which you accept that maybe you won't be as productive as you could be in the area you're more comfortable,
which is difficult,
really hard for yourself and also for your supervisor.
I think that's
a struggle for a lot of PhD students, or
especially when you're on like a time limited PhD and funding limited as well, you know.
Absolutely.
It's even harder because I do always say, I would almost prefer to be in the other, on the other side, and be, you know, like a wet lab scientist wanting to learn bioinformatics, because it's something that I feel like you can self-teach to a certain point, you know. Whereas if you're computational and you're wanting to get in the lab, you can't, you know, I can't just like walk in a lab and just start playing around with stuff, you know. But then also, you said, it's finding,
you could, but it wouldn't necessarily go very well.
I can promise you now that it would not go well, even in undergrad with instructions.
This is also true for people when they start out in the bioinformatics.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I'm, well. Yeah.
Maybe less risk of poisoning yourself or others.
It's like you said, it's just finding the time, isn't it? It's just, yeah. So yeah, anyway, sorry, single cell, great explanation. I think it's so cool, so cool. We always say it's like the hot new thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's been the hot new thing for a few years, and I think it's in a bit of a transition at the moment. You know, there's definitely a period where, you know, single cell was enough to get you a paper published in a flashy journal without necessarily a lot behind it. And now I think it's sort of been a massive data collection exercise in many ways. And I've absolutely been part of that, and the work that we've been doing is, you know, generating these resources that now require actually some really careful experimental design and hypothesis testing, which I think is going to be the exciting part, and what I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into in the next few years.
It's just the more difficult part. So can you, if I said to you, like, sum up the paper in like three sentences, how would you do it? Like, what do you think are the, I don't know, the three most important findings that paper sort of brought to the field?
So one, I think, is partly that data resource. So we provide a very comprehensive annotation, transcriptomic profiling of the tonsil and the cell states, and in quite a comprehensive way. And the second thing that we found, I think, which is really was surprising to us, was that a particular process called class switch recombination occurs before B cells enter the germinal center. I talked a lot about the germinal center before. I talked a lot about antibodies. I mentioned that there are many different types of antibodies, you know, IgG or IgA and so on. So all B cells normally express, so this is way over the three sentences, but so B cells before the germinal center will express an isotype called IgM. During their sort of maturation,
sorry, can I interrupt now and ask a question? So I, as I'm listening to you, realize how rubbish I am immunology, and I actually did really well in my immunology module. But so what are, do the different classes have different functions?
I definitely got taught this at undergraduate and it's literally gone from my head. So do they have different functions?
Yeah, they will have different effects on the type of immune response that can be formed. Mm-hmm. A very simple example is IgE mm-hmm. is very strongly linked with inflammation. It mm-hmm. is going to drive a very particular type of inflammatory response, which is why if you have too much IgE, it can lead to asthma or allergy.
Right, yeah.
Other types of different antibodies they have different roles in terms of like mucosal surfaces, where IgA is really a lot more dominant. Different types of IgG can have different effects on sort of interacting with other cells in the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important that the right types of antibodies are made.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's one of the aspects we don't understand exactly how that happens.
Yeah. Okay. That was going to be my next question. But
the process, we know broadly what happens, but we don't know how the different types are specified as part of that. So
mm-hmm.
broadly what happens is a process called class switch recombination.
Mm-hmm.
So the antibody class switches to another class via recombination.
Okay. I've not heard of this before. I've not heard of this before. So that's interesting.
It's a really fascinating thing. We could have a whole podcast just about this process.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
If you imagine, so the antibody gene locus or the heavy chain of immunoglobulin
mm-hmm.
has all of, is organized in a very particular way. You have a lot of the variable genes, which are sort of all selected for in the bone marrow. So well before this, we won't worry about that. And then you have the 10 different types of antibody isotype. You have an individual gene for each one of them. And they're located on the same part of the chromosome, right next to each other.
Right.
In a very particular order. And so what happens when you go from, when you switch from one to the other, is you have IgM at the most 5' part of the locus.
Mm-hmm.
The DNA gets looping out the IgM, bringing the other parts of the locus together, and that IgM is deleted by recombination. Now
that's really interesting.
Now putting another gene in frame, mm-hmm. which is then expressed as the antibody.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I've literally never heard of this, and that's really fascinating.
It's really quite amazing, and all sorts of things about the chromatin organization of this, and this process is driven by non-coding transcription from intergenic promoters next to each one of these different genes.
Mm-hmm.
But what's also quite important is that it's, you know, because it's deletional, it can only happen in a certain way. It can only happen in one direction.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've sort of gone to the end of the locus, you can't go back.
Right, yeah.
So it's a really fascinating molecular biology, which is sort of a whole podcast of it in itself.
Yeah. So do we know how that happens? Like, are there particular cases where this happens and where it doesn't? Or
yeah. So what? Yeah. So I'm just thinking about how to explain this. So we do know how it happens in general. So we have the locus, and we have these, you know, 9 or 10 different genes, each one of which has a intergenic promoter that's sort of next to it.
Mm-hmm.
Near that promoter, or as well as those promoters, you also have some major enhancer hubs,
mm-hmm.
Super enhancers, locus control regions, whatever you might call them.
Mm-hmm.
At this locus, they just call them enhancer regions.
Mm-hmm.
And these obviously have a lot of transcription factor binding sites, which a lot of these transcription factors are downstream of different cytokine pathways. So in the right signaling context, the transcription factors will bind to this locus, will mm-hmm. bind to individual gene regulatory elements, and that can trigger, in some contexts, transcription from these intergenic promoters.
Mm-hmm.
These promoters are actually antisense to the major gene itself, and they transcribe across these repetitive elements called switch regions, which are basically Yeah, this is a lot.
I can see now why you was like, how do I answer this?
But it's really interesting. So you have these enhancer regions that control in some way these intergenic promoters, that do non-coding transcripts across repetitive switch regions.
Wow.
This is thought to remodel the chromatin and allow the three-dimensional contacts to form required for this recombination. And then you have specific recombination machinery, which, you know, can then
cut. Very complex, but that is so interesting. I've literally never heard of this before.
But it's a really important process. One, because it's important in shaping the types of antibodies that are made.
Yep.
And if it goes wrong, it can lead to cancer. So one of a really common mutation that can occur in different types of B-cell cancer is the fusion of this antibody gene locus with something like MYC, which many people will be familiar as like a massive driver of oncogenic growth. And so it just really can, because you're breaking the DNA and having to stitch it back together. So when that goes wrong, that's a, you know, that's a, not going to be a great outcome. So anyway, if I think that's probably, I'll leave it there for the moment and just say that if it, historically, this process has been described to occur within the germinal center B cells. So the B cells are going to the germinal center. This is where this happens. And one of the things that we found was evidence that actually that might not be accurate, that it can also happen before the cells enter that process, which has important implications for how the cells then behave within the germinal center, whether they form a germinal center, whether they do something else. And something that was really vindicating was we made this prediction from the bioinformatic analysis in, I think, when was it? Let's say 2019, we first sort of made this observation. And then since then, work from Robert Brink and the Garvan Institute in Sydney have found the same, and others actually have in mouse models made the same observations and tested this experimentally and found, you know, I sort of talked about the differences between mouse and human, but there are broadly lots of similarities as well. So it was really sort of nice to see that the predictions that we made from a single cell analysis were borne out in sort of, I guess, more experimental context, proving that or suggesting that hypothesis is likely to be true.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's so cool. So cool. Yeah. When did, like, how long have we known about this class switching thing? Like, is it a fairly new thing or?
No, it's been known about for a very long time.
So maybe I was taught it in immunology decades. It just, who knows, maybe I have heard about it before.
Or you may have just been taught it in the context of B cells can switch from IgM to IgG.
Maybe.
Or IgA. You know, that may have been it.
But the epigenetics of it is always more interesting.
it's a really another example why B cells are particularly fascinating, I think, in the context of epigenetic and gene regulation systems that aren't present in many other cell types.
Yeah, definitely. Have you got a third point?
Have I got a third point? So
it doesn't have to be a sentence, it can be a point.
I think the third point was that we were, I guess I sort of finished the second point half an hour later by saying that if the B cells are switching before a germinal center, that affects how they behave within the germinal center. So we were able to use our single cell gene expression to ask that question and say, if you have a B cell that expresses one type of antibody in the germinal center, is it transcriptionally different to B cells that express another type of antibody? And we found evidence that there are differences that could relate to the phenotype of those cells and how long they reside within the germinal center, whether they're more likely to differentiate into one fate or another, whether they're more likely to survive or die. In very broad strokes, we sort of found evidence of that may be the case. I think those are probably the three main points.
Yeah, so on that last one, what you mentioned about, like, so Okay, so they can do this class switching thing, right? But what exactly is the function, like, if this is going to make any sense, what is the function of the classes in the germinal center? Like, how does it determine, like, what exactly does it determine?
Good question. So I guess we often might think about B cells as being secreted by or antibodies secreting by B cells. But actually, B cells express antibodies on their cell surface for most of their life. So they're expressing their antibodies as a membrane-bound receptor,
mm-hmm.
Which signals, you know, provides a signal to that cell to do different things.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talked before about B cells developing affinity towards a foreign particle, mm-hmm. the way that works is they're expressing the antibody on their cell surface. They are presented with that foreign particle, and if it is a good match, it sends a strong signal inside the B cell to change its mm-hmm. behavior. If it's not a match at all, nothing will happen. If it's a weak mm-hmm. match, it gets a weak signal. It's sort of the general model.
Right.
So
yep.
coming back to your question, what is the importance of the classes? So one of the ways that the classes are different is that the intracellular domain of the antibody in that form is different.
Mm-hmm.
So how the B cell receptor, as it's called, interfaces with different signaling networks could potentially be very different. And there was evidence within the literature that was likely to be the case.
Is this something that could potentially like translate into diseases like autoimmune? Like, could this be something that plays a role in like autoimmunity and things like that?
So we know that in something like allergy, for example, that particular types of antibodies are really overrepresented. So IgE and IgG4.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
So the hope, you know, one of the main motivations for this type of work was to ask whether there's anything specific about B cells expressing IgG4. Mm-hmm. compared to cells expressing IgG2, that could hint at how they've developed differently.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you could speculate, you could intervene in some way mm-hmm. to maybe push it in one direction or another.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we couldn't actually answer that question in this data set, because these in the tonsil, in normal healthy kids, these isotypes are really rare,
mm-hmm.
but we were sort of able to ask them more broader questions about when B cells undergo class switching recombination or don't undergo it, because they won't always undergo it, they might not change.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we didn't unfortunately answer the question we set out to ask as well as we hoped.
Yeah, but that always happens, isn't it? Always something gets in the way. So everyone involved in the study, so can you tell me a little bit about the people involved in the study? Did you just mention, were they were children?
Yes, so they were children from the Royal London Hospital, which is right next to the Blizzard Institute where mm-hmm. I work. We worked with a surgical collaborator, Nara Orban, one of the team there. And they were just children who were undergoing routine tonsillectomies. And there's two main reasons that they have them removed. One is if they have had repeated tonsillitis. So mm-hmm. if they are just constantly getting infected tonsils, it's so disruptive, it's really awful. If you've had tonsillitis, mm-hmm. it's not a lot of fun. So they will remove the tonsils. And in other cases, they're removed because they're simply too large and they could be obstructive.
I didn't know that was a thing either.
Yeah, so even in these very young children, with very young children with large tonsils, it can, you know, cause sleep apnea,
mm-hmm.
difficulty sleeping. So in those cases, they will also remove the tonsils as well. And we had a fairly even mix between those two groups in our sample.
So they were all, you would like consider all of them as healthy?
So yeah, it's an interesting question that we get asked a lot. So certainly at the time of the surgery, they don't have an infection. The tonsils are not, you know, undergoing, you know, they're not sick. They have a history of infection, I guess you would say, and maybe it's different. But I think this is, again, where having both groups is important. So the patients with obstructive sleep apnea, very large, in some ways a control for that because they haven't been as sick. So we didn't find any major differences between those two groups, but we did have a very small sample size. But other studies have found few differences that likely impact the findings of that work. But it is very complicated as well, because sometimes, you know, if these children have very large tonsils, they might also get infections more often. If children have repeated infections, their tonsils are much larger than they are normally. So it's a question that I'm often asked, and I think that we have a good basis to treat these tissue as healthy. It's a caveat. The other aspect, the other thing that we did was we compared our data set from these tonsils with those generated from lymph nodes or spleen, or similar tissue types from cadaver donor patients who are, you know, typically 40 to 50 years old, who died from natural causes as part of the Human Cell Atlas project, for example. And we found very similar populations and states of cells.
Oh, okay, interesting, because I was going to ask next if it's something that you think you might see different results, like between children and adults, for example, if you think it's something that aging might play a part in. Or
so aging definitely does play a part. And we saw in the analysis while we integrated these data sets together that although all of the same populations were present, they weren't present in the same frequency. So the germinal center cells in particular are much less common in elderly individuals compared to these young kids. And this is well known by many studies. And generally, we, you know, I think we all understand that as we age, our immune systems weaken and are less able to handle these sort of responses. One reason is that the germinal center responses aren't as present or aren't as active.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what if I said to you that you had like unlimited funding to just do whatever you want? What exactly would you do? Like, what's your sort of like your dream question, I guess, of the field to be able to answer?
This is like an interview question for
is it? I'll take notes then for interviews. I'll make sure I have an answer ready for that.
This is actually a question that is very common at academic interviews.
Is it? Yeah. Well, okay, well, that's good to know. I'll make sure I come up with an answer.
So for me, what I'm sort of really interested in understanding what I would use that unlimited money to tackle is how...
I mean, that's normally why we're not doing what we want to do, right? And science is...
Yeah.
It's normally money's limiting it or technology.
Yeah. So some of this work is being done by others, but relating to the intersection of these data sets with human disease, I think that there's a lot of effort going now and near unlimited money being thrown at this problem of profiling different autoimmune diseases in terms of the genes and chromatin activities that are going on and how those differ in different patients and how that relates to normal healthy states. So that's one aspect. I think we still need, you know, a lot of the single cell genomics field is really now giving us a lot of insight into normal inverted commas tissue states.
Yeah,
but a lot of what's going on is you know, in disease, we need to be looking at the disease and in the right tissues at the right times.
I was about to say, I guess it's so
hard to tackle with the timing of these diseases, because separating out, you know, a patient who's had a diagnosis for a disease for even a year is probably in a very different state to someone who's developing that disease but has no idea that that's going on. So I think one of the challenges that we need to do is to build better models of these, of the immune system and these processes. And so one of the things that I will be doing in my lab is using organoid culture systems of this process from tonsil immune cells, where we can grow these cells in vitro or ex vivo, and combining that with different screening and genetic manipulations to sort of tackle some of these questions in a hopefully a more translatable context, potentially to model some disease pathology progression. I think that's a much longer term goal, to be honest. But at the very least, using it as the closest thing that we have to understanding gene regulation in human tissue by integrating CRISPR-Cas9 screening strategies and other functional epigenomics. I don't know if that answers that.
Sounds fascinating. So you're going to be doing a lot of bioinformatics and wet lab stuff in your lab then?
The plan is it will definitely be a bit of a hybrid lab. Looking to recruit both computational and wet lab scientists and training people in the areas that they're not versed in. Definitely
amazing
combination. And at the WEHI, where I'll be joining, is a very strong community in both computational and experimental genomics. So lots of resources that I'll be drawing on as well.
Amazing, cool. When are you hiring?
So I'm in the process of recruiting at the moment.
Cool.
I will not be starting in person in the lab until early next year. A lot of barriers to travel back to Australia at the moment.
I can imagine.
As well as aiming to finish up some projects here at Queen Mary. But definitely, if anyone's interested in
I can
questions about gene regulation for PhDs or postdocs, definitely get in touch.
If you have I don't know if maybe you've got a link or anything you can share, I can put it in the description in case anyone's interested. Maybe I'm sure there will be someone.
I hope so. Hopefully there's at least someone.
It sounds really, really cool. I'm realizing that I have literally forgot some of the basic I did forget some of the basic immunology. So sorry if you feel like I was asking you stupid questions.
No, not at all. I think it's really helpful to be asked questions. I'll just call them questions, not stupid questions. Because it is complicated, and I've only started working on B cells in 4 years ago, and I'm still boggled at how complicated immunology. It's definitely, I think I'm finally starting to understand this one particular type of cell a little bit, and there's still so much I don't know. And
That's intimidating. This is how I always felt about immunology. Surprisingly, I actually did okay in my immunology. I think I did. I'm sure I did. But immunology to me, I don't know why, but it's always for me, I just find it a very, very complex topic, and I don't know what it is about it. But I just find it very complex. So I admire that you are doing all of this really, really cool research.
I think you're not alone in that, and I definitely find the same thing. In some ways, it was quite interesting coming to this project without all that background knowledge, without that training, if you like, because we were using this unbiased approach of single cell. I was sort of learning from the data. The data was telling me what was present, rather than I think if I had done my PhD in immunology and B cells, I might have been more tempted to fit things into boxes. Whereas I hope I was able to follow the data a little bit more and sort of see what it was actually telling me.
Well, I think that's amazing, because I think, like you said, when you sort of have a little bit of a background on a topic, you kind of go into it trying to see things in your data. And as much as anyone tries to deny, I think we all at times definitely do, we do put things in boxes, don't we?
Yeah,
and try and make our data fit, and then So
we have to label things, and it really, I think, is for a reason. Like we need to be able to process things in a particular way, but I think we can get beholden to that, and that's why I think immunology happens quite a lot. And genomics too. I mean, if you think about, you know, how we talk about the genome, the types of the parts of the genome, you know, promoters and enhancers.
And then
all the different categories of enhancers that people have come up with, and all sorts of different regulatory elements. And I think it's, you know, I've often wondered at times, like, is this actually helping? You know, what are we? And you know, these are behaviors, but they're not unique necessarily. Like even the fact that enhancers are essentially another type of promoter. You know, we see like they recruit polymerase, they produce RNAs, you know, but they're behaving slightly differently. So it's really interesting, I think, question about how we approach these different.
I think you're so right. And I think that's so true, especially when it comes to epigenetics. Even, you know, like DNA methylation, for example, like that classic thing of like, well, when we see DNA methylation at promoters, we think it's, you know, gene silencing, but it's just not always the case. And that's definitely something that I've seen in my research is that actually isn't the case. So when I, for example, when I first see results, I'm like, oh, cool, this is exactly what I want to see. And then Radu would be like, no, but just check that is actually what's happening. And then you look and it's not, you know? So I think that is definitely true when it comes to, I think that's quite a common thing in epigenetics, is from what I've seen anyway.
Absolutely. Because a lot of and because I think a lot of people who come to any different field, you know, epigenetics is one I think that has drawn attention from many different fields as well. And you can't be an expert in everything. Yes. Like we were talking about before, in terms of, you know, learning computational experimental work, it's very hard to be an expert in both. And I wouldn't say I'm an expert in both. I'm definitely, like, you know, somewhere, you know, doing okay in both of them, but you sort of need to people will sort of have a lot of blind faith in things sometimes.
Absolutely. But we'll just argue that it's because it's such a complex topic. So
it is a very complex topic.
We're not doing it intentionally.
No.
Okay, amazing. So yeah, I will link the, if you send me that link over, I'll put it in just in case anyone is interested. I will also link that paper, which it definitely is published now, isn't it? So I will link that. And have you got Twitter or anything, if anyone wants to contact you or talk to you about anything?
You can find me on Twitter at Hamish_King. Very happy to hear from anyone who needs me to explain class structure combination again or send some useful diagrams, perhaps.
Maybe someone will want to discuss it more, but I don't think they'll need another explanation because you gave a great explanation. So
that's very kind.
But yeah, no, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I had a great time.
Nice to be back filming because, yeah, like I said, it's literally been like 6 weeks since I filmed an episode. So, yeah, it's been good.
Excellent.
So, yeah, thank you so much.
Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for this episode.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter at The Genomics Lab. That's got a capital G and a capital L.
You can actually also find both of us on Instagram, at a genomics PhD and at PhD_Ellie.
Finally, be sure to subscribe to us on your favourite podcast platform, and we will see you all in the next episode. Thank you again for listening.